Okay, the next argued case is number 17-12-12, Radware Limited against F5 Networks Incorporated. Mr. Marino.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The Court should affirm the judgment of the District Court that the Radware patents are valid and infringed, but it should reverse four erroneous rulings, pre-trial rulings by the District Court relating to the 702 patent, the hot fixes, damages, and then reinstate the jury's verdict of willful infringement of the 319 patent. Given the time limitations and our focus on the 702 patent issues, the damages issues, and address the other two as time permits.
Let me just ask you one question about the damages issue.
Yes, sir.
I've read the district court opinion. I've read the briefs. And they don't give us a very clear picture of what happened in discovery. Presumably, there was an interrogatory or something like that asking for your damages theory. Is that correct?
No, there was a preliminary damages disclosure. There was
pursuant to the automatic disclosure?
Correct.
Okay. And in making that disclosure, you referred to your expert report?
We did not. In that preliminary disclosure, I can give you the appendix side if you'd like. We identified, it was very early in the case, we identified the accused product being the BKP product, which is all of them, and they all were found to infringe, and we said we're entitled to reasonable royalties as well as lost profits. That was the preliminary disclosure. Subsequent to that, during discovery, we also supplemented the disclosure to refer to the expert report.
Where, is that document in the record here?
I believe it is. I don't have a precise site. But, you know, I think even from the court's rulings, it's clear that the court was referred to anything in the report by our expert to be properly disclosed.
Well, yes, I understand that. But if I agree with the district court that the expert report didn't properly disclose this, what I then ask myself is whether you identify the expert report as the source of your disclosure of your damages theories.
I believe we did, Your Honor. I don't have the precise site immediately. I will get it for you.
Okay.
I think that point was given by the district court, agreed with that contention. And just to focus the issue on damages, what the district court did wasn't limit us to what the expert had disclosed. If they had done that, it would be a different case. What the district court did was to blue pencil the expert's opinion. So the expert gave a comprehensive damages disclosure that included damages, the LTM and the GTM versions of the BKP product, and the district court excluded a very significant portion of those damages that the expert had given an opinion on. And the best place to see
okay,
that...
Okay, but the problem is the expert only calculated damages for licensed product. And then you decided that you wanted to extend that to include a product that wasn't licensed because of the capability existed.
That is not quite correct, Your Honor. What we did is we accused from the very beginning every single sale of the BKP product. Every single sale.
No, but I'm talking about, you may have accused it, but the damages calculation, presumably because unlicensed products might be difficult to show damages because the user wouldn't be using it without a license. But as I understand it, the expert report limited itself to licensed product. Is that not correct?
I don't understand what you mean by licensed product.
Well, so the word is used in the brief.
Right, no, so I want to make sure we're precise. So you sell a license to the software on the product when you sell the product.
So that you can access that functionality in the software.
To that. The expert, and this is in the appendix at page 5597, that's the summary of his damages opinions from his report, which the district court concedes this was what he disclosed, includes every sale with a license to the LTM module or the GTM module or the link controller module. Any one of the three. Very clear from this page, appendix 5597, which was also an exhibit we wanted to introduce at trial. The court struck this exhibit. They said it goes beyond what I'm going to allow you to present.
Yeah, but it goes beyond what you disclosed earlier.
Well, we obviously had disclosed it because it was in the expert report.
Well, that's the question. The question is what was disclosed in the expert report. you make one argument about what was disclosed, the district court found something else. So I don't want
to... That is correct, but I just want to be clear on what we're all talking about, saying that. So let me go back to the 702 for a minute. So in the 702, what we have is a claim construction error. So the F5 move for summary judgment of non-infringement based only on the district court's claim construction. It did not move under our proposed claim construction. So if we're correct that the claim construction was erroneous, then the summary judgment has to be reversed as well. And the claim construction was primarily the term proximity, which appears in claim 8, for example, the 702 patent. And the error...
The heart of your argument is that proximity and network proximity are the same thing, right?
Or at least substantially overlapping. So if we just look at the claim language itself, proximity is a more generic term than network proximity. Network proximity should be at least as broad in this context.
Well, so why does the specification go to great lengths to define network proximity? Because that's not a term that is used in any of the claims, nor is it a term, so far as I can tell, that was used in the parent 801 patent claims either, right?
So I think the definition of network proximity, as you noted, was introduced in the patent application. It was retained in the subsequent patents, including...
Why? What function did it serve?
Because I think when they say proximity, they meant to include at least network proximity. And in fact, the file history specifically confirms that.
Were there ever claims, whether initially filed or issued in any parent applications, that went to the subject of the network proximity, namely choosing which server to go to, where you have more than one possible server and you're trying to figure out which one to go to on the basis of some notion of proximity? Or were claims always about the different topic? Once you know what server you want to get to, choose the path as to which you can say it has the best proximity. So with the endpoint fixed.
So the other one patent was primarily directed to the GSLB, the global server load balancing, to choosing which server farm to go to two different ones.
The earlier one.
Okay, so that explains why it's in there. But the term, the very terms in the spec of the network proximity definition, which is what you proposed, make no sense when you're talking about the problem of we know which server we want to go to, we're trying to figure out what path. Because it's a comparison of different servers.
It's a comparison of difference of paths to different
servers. I'm sorry, network proximity definition in the spec and in your proposed construction is by its terms a comparison of paths to different servers. That makes no sense as a construction of a term in a context where you know a single server is where you're going to and you're just trying to compare different paths to that server.
No, I would respectfully disagree. The proximity is a quality of the path between a client and a server. So I have proximity between a client and two different servers. I'll have two different proximity. I think of proximity as distance. I can talk about the distance between client and servers.
Please, you gotta let me ask sure. The question because time is limited. It seemed to me that the network proximity, and then I want you to respond to this, it seemed to me that the network proximity definition in the spec cannot possibly be the right construction for proximity because it doesn't even make sense. So now the question is, we have the term proximity. The term proximity, who knows what that means? So you do what our law tells you to do, look at the spec. And is it right to say that every time the patent talks about proximity when asking which of two paths to the same server you want to, you know, has the better proximity, it relies on at least one of the three things, latency and whatever the other two things are, that the district court called out?
So in the embodiment, if I understand the question, so in the specific embodiments of figure 3 and figure 4, which are the ones that go to the same server over two different routes, it talks about, it gives those three examples. And I agree.
And it never refers to anything else, right?
The examples are all specific to those, one of those three metrics. However, and I take the point, I think it's a good point, that network proximity, as it is defined as a definition in its totality, perhaps is too expensive to read on proximity. There is clearly overlap between the two, right? So hops and latency are given as specific examples, both for GSLB and for LLB. So clearly the metrics can be the same, or at least some of them can be. So the real problem that I have with this course construction is that it completely ignores the definition of network proximity. And I think there is parts of that definition that are relevant and inform the definition of proximity. For example, the concept that proximity is the quality of the relationship between a client and a server, considering multiple metrics, and it's an open-ended list of metrics. Conversely, the district court just limited it to the one embodiment on one of those three metrics.
Well, let me just for purposes of, let me ask. So, suppose for a minute that the district court was incorrect to say that proximity was limited to those three things, and instead should have said at least one of those three things has to be part of the proximity calculation. That doesn't change the summary judgment result because the only proximity, the only aspect of the accused products that you accuse involves none of those three things.
Yeah, that would be because that was what the district court found. But if it said such as one of those three, then it would have been a different result.
Right, but that's a different point. And what do you make of the fact, I guess it's at the top of column 2 or 4, right-hand side column on a left-hand side page, that the district court said, figuring out how long the server is going to take to respond is actually part of a later step in the process, not the proximity determination.
Well, I think that supports the concept that it's the quality of the relationship between the client and the server. So how long it might take the server to respond would certainly influence latency when you respond. So I think that I think the real point here is even if you don't adopt word per word the definition of network proximity, should have given some way in giving a construction of the term proximity, which seems on its face to include at least a substantial portion of network proximity. And for example, the real claim limitation...
I'm having difficulty understanding, since you agree they're not the same, you suggest there's overlap. I don't know how looking at the definition of network proximity really helps you decide what the term proximity means. I mean, the use of two different terms suggests that they have different meanings.
Well, they're used interchangeably in certain parts of the specification. For example, with respect to proximity table, which is found both in Figure 2 and in Figure 3D. Figure 2A is in the GSLB portion, and Figure 3D is in the LLB portion. They're both called proximity table. So, and the court even said in the claim construction order, the appendix at page 9, that the inventor shortened the term network proximity to proximity when describing Figure 2A. So I think it's very hard to draw the conclusion that the inventors intended to say two completely different things. And as I said, there is a part of the file history that's very instructive that we addressed in our opening brief, and F5 did not respond to in their response, and the district court didn't address this in its own claim construction order. That is in the appendix of 3706. And that is that when in the 319 patent we had the claims, after the original filing, we had to identify support in the specification for those claims. Those new claims included the word proximity. And we identified as support in the spec the very portion of the specification that defines network proximity. So at least the file history lends strong support to an equivalence between network proximity and proximity, not a disjunctive reading, which is what the district court really did here. So I think for those reasons, we would urge the court to reverse the claim construction. I'm going to briefly talk about damages beyond. I think you kind of put the spotlight on the real issue, which is if in fact, and I think that's the argument that F5 makes, the district court was trying to cabin us to what was disclosed in the expert report, then we should have been cabined to that. We should have been cabined to a subset of that. How did the district court cabin us to a subset of what the expert had put in his summary of damages? By saying, you cannot get damages for all the infringing products. You can only get damages for all the infringing products for which the user has bought a license to a specific module. But not only that, that module, so 114...
Turn license, turn infringing module.
But infringing module is no concept. It doesn't exist. So the accused product is a big IP that has 14 modules. This is a situation that's indistinguishable from the situation in Fingen.
Yeah, but I understand.
There were 8 modules, right?
Yeah, I understand. But what the district court is saying is that you didn't disclose that you were seeking damages with respect to items where there was no license that would have made the use infringing, correct?
Well, that's not what the expert said. That's what the district court concluded.
Yeah.
What the expert said is if the product doesn't infringe, then of course I have to take it out of my damages. But if the product does infringe, I have to count it. And that's, if you look at both the summary of
that. So you're arguing about what the expert report disclosed.
Correct. So we see. I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time unless you have a question.
Yes, you've saved some time for a rebuttal. We'll see what it includes. Mr. Al-Salam.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm not sure what subjects you would like me to start with. With respect to the 702 patent, I agree completely with what Judge Toronto was mentioning. The network proximity definition was in the parent, which only disclosed global server load balancing. The 702 patent comes from a continuation in part application, which added new subject matter with respect to ISP load balancing. And as the court mentioned, the distinction is when you're talking about ISP load balancing, you're only going to a single server or server farm. So server capacity, for example, makes no sense in that context. There is nothing to compare in terms of server capacity. And the only examples of proximity in the ISP load balancing context are the three we talked about, latency, hops, and time to live. And time to live is a form of hops. The other thing about this claim language we need to keep in mind, the proximity ratings are for routes. You are rating routes. So something like server processing capacity is not even a route-based measurement. And the fastest link measurement, which the court is referring to, is not a route-based measurement. The fastest link measurement is equivalent to determining how many people are trying to get on an on-ramp at a given intersection on the interstate. It is not a measure of how long a route that begins at that intersection to some destination will take, or how many intersections there are on the way. Hops is equivalent to intersections. I will move on quickly to the damages portion issue, which Judge Dyke has raised. This is what you have to keep in mind. The big IP is a 14-module product, and the way it's sold is customers license a certain module one at a time, and they pay for that module. Their expert...
But the physical thing that they get, in fact, has the capability there if only it is properly turned on.
Yes.
And because of the claim language in, this is the 319, the relevant claims, the court said all of those products, no matter what's turned on, in fact are infringing because that has a pretty broad capability term. And then the court said, but what damages you would get actually depend on what functionality is used by the individual, and that in turn, by the user, and that in turn depends on whether they license LTM only, LTM plus GTM, one or the other.
The court didn't say that. That's what their expert said. In other words, I agree. The court said for every big IP device that we sell or we distribute, that is an act of infringement. And that's the Fingen case.
And what the court said was that even though that's an act of infringement, I read the damages report, which was the disclosure of their damages theory, to be limited to situations in which there was a license that would have rendered the use infringing.
Yeah, well, yes. I think of it this way. What the expert said, and I can certainly cite portions in both in his report and in his testimony, he said, I have chosen to base damages on sales and revenues of modules that practice the patented functionality. So, and let's keep in mind, it would be unreasonable to do otherwise. And I want to step back. If that expert had told us at the beginning, I'm going to base a reasonable royalty for infringement on a percentage of sales of modules that don't even practice the invention, we would have moved to exclude that. And Judge White noted that too, I think in Appendix 71 in his order. He said, you can't seek lost profits on the sale of a module that doesn't even practice the infringing
So you could have sought a reasonable royalty on a module which has no use because it wasn't licensed. You could ask for a reasonable royalty. Presumably, the reasonable royalty might be quite small.
It wouldn't be based on the revenues from modules that don't have anything to do with the patented functionality. In other words, let's put it in perspective. LTM is our best seller. $800 million of revenue was at issue at the beginning for LTM, which is in the report at 4135-36. $245 million in revenue was for GTM. For Link Controller, the product that was accused to be a copy, it was $4 million in revenue. So to base a reasonable royalty for infringement on an $800 million of sales of a module that doesn't even practice any of the claimed functionality would have been, I'm sorry to say, it's outrageous. You can't base a reasonable royalty for infringement on revenues that aren't tied to practicing the patent. And that's the problem here. I agree that Mr. Nalikowski...
I'm not sure that's true, because if it has the capability and could be licensed, and the customer saw some benefit in having that capability in its hands, so if it chose to get the license later, it might be appropriate to have a reasonable royalty. I think your characterization of that theory is outrageous, not correct, but that's not the same thing as saying that that was the expert's theory when the disclosure was made.
The expert's theory was definitely based on the assumption that the modules, that the revenues from those modules, that those modules could practice ISP load balancing. And I can certainly point you to both portions of the report and to his testimony. For example, in his testimony, he said, this is at 5531, he admitted that one of his assumptions was that LTM, quote, can perform outbound link load balancing on its own, end quote. At 5532, he said, quote, I confirmed with Dr. Rubin that it's his opinion that LTM still infringes as originally accused, and two, I understand that to the extent the jury determines that it does not infringe, then it would be removed from my analysis. So he's talking about LTM and the assumption that the revenues that were generated by licensing of LTM were related to the fact that LTM could practice the invention. Now, once we know that LTM can't practice the invention, it would be improper to seek lost profits or a reasonable royalty.
Just to be clear, what I understand to be going on here is that, and I think you may disagree with part of this, but that it's, in your view, it's immaterial. He might well have been able to testify, as Judge Dyke, I think, alluded to, that somebody might have paid a certain royalty to get an LTM-only license because down the road that user might want to have thought, I might add the other functionality so that I can actually do this link load balancing. But he never did that. He never said, here is my royalty rate for a currently non-functional LTM license. And if he didn't say it before, he's not going to be able to do it for the first time at trial. And hence, the assumptions of his royalty calculation are no longer accurate, and he doesn't have a royalty theory, and maybe even worse on the lost profits side, why would somebody be buying this as a substitute for their product when the functionality isn't even there?
I agree with the analysis. In terms of, to keep in mind, it's the GTM and the link controller that actually can perform the accused functionality or the patented functionality. So the question is would it be reasonable for him to have said, and he didn't say it, and that's the main point, as you say, would it be reasonable to say, even though these other 13 modules, or I guess it's 12 modules, do not perform the accused functionality, and some of them perform functionalities that has nothing to do with even something close, their security module, for example, could if he sought a reasonable royalty for revenue or lost profits for revenues generated from and sales of those modules? I think that's questionable, but I understand that perhaps it's conceptually possible and it would be some very small minimal royalty, but that was never in his report. His report was expressly based on the assumption that the modules that he was looking at for lost profits and reasonable royalty could practice the patented functionality. And again, if it hadn't been, if it had been different, we would have moved to exclude such a theory, especially on lost profits. I mean, lost profits, you get lost profits when, but for the infringement, you would have made a sale. The sale of an LTM module is not even a module that practices the patent. So how can you get lost profits on the sale of a
patent? I'm sorry, it does practice the patent because the patent is, and the judge held that, right, on summary judgment. It doesn't provide a functionality of interest.
Well, I want to distinguish.
These are infringing units as a result of an unappealed summary judgment, right?
Well,
because the material is in there, and therefore it's capable under whatever that broad language is. It doesn't have to be turned on for it to be infringing. Wasn't that what the district court held?
Yes, but that's the big IP versus the LTM. The big IP device.
Isn't the LTM just a module inside the device?
Yes.
And it's contained in what every single big IP, everyone that's sold.
Correct.
So if the sale of a big IP is an act of infringement.
Yes, but we don't sell big IPs separately from modules. So what I'm distinguishing is the sale of the LTM module, which is priced differently than sales of other modules, for example. So the sale of the LTM module itself is not revenue related to an act of infringement. I agree with you that when we deliver a big IP device, you've bought an LTM module. You bought a module that can't practice the patented functionality. You do have a box that has code in it that could practice the patented functionality. To get access to that code, you have to license GTM or link controller, and you pay for that. And if you pay for that, that would be revenue that was related to your ability to practice the patented functionality. I don't dispute that the big IP, the product itself, has non-enabled code in there that would allow you, if you paid for it, to get access to it.
So are you raising a cross appeal?
Excuse me?
Are you raising a cross appeal?
Yes, our cross appeal, it's that the court and judge, I will say Judge White's opinions, as are evident from a review of them, are very thoughtful. He thoughtfully analyzes the evidence and his conclusions and the law. But we believe that the jury decision that the two prior art devices that we identified was against the clear weight of the evidence. That the issue is not whether these devices existed prior to the critical date. There doesn't seem to be an issue with that. The issue seems to be whether or not there was sufficient evidence that they could work as a single device. And in terms of a single device...
Could work as a single device? No, the issue was whether they were used as a single device.
Or whether, not whether used, because the claim constructions don't require use, whether they were... In my view, there's undisputed testimony that they're capable of being used to do link load balancing. The question might be whether they were ever sold as together for the purpose of being used as a single device or were ever implemented as a single device. We think that there was unrebutted testimony that they were repeatedly sold and used by customers as part of the same rack. They were put in a rack. And Mr. Skeen and Mr. Needham and Mr. Thornywell all testified to that effect. I understand Judge White felt that there, to some extent, there wasn't a clear demarcation about the timing of that, but if you read the testimony in context, it's clear that they were saying from the beginning. Now, that they did cite something from Mr. Skeen, which says, when was the first time they were put together as a single device? And he said 2002, but if you read that page of testimony, he means in the same packaging. He said it's just as a form factor issue. He wasn't undermining his own testimony that since the beginning they were intended to work together and were working together and used by customers for that purpose. I only have 20 seconds left. Are there any other issues the court would like me to address? Because obviously on the primary appeal there were a lot of issues raised.
I guess so, since you have 16 seconds, what is the difference between a user putting in an activation code and doing whatever this patch thing is that you say was necessary in order to undo at least the second hotfix?
That's a good question. And this is what we're left with. Lots of products can be modified to infringe, but as sold, they don't meet all the elements of a claim. And what we're dealing with here is this is not an indirect infringement claim. It's not that we're being accused of inducing somebody to modify the product. The issue is whether, as sold, that product practices the claim. And in software cases, for example, under FinGen, the issue is whether, as sold, it is operable or possibly capable of practicing the claimed functionality. In the FinGen case, the court found that having locked modules still were capable of practicing the claim because all the customer needed to do was license those modules and unlock them. And the court, in FinGen and in Fantasy Sports, made the distinction that the code doesn't have to be modified. There's no modification to the code. And that is the distinction here.
Well, I'm not sure. Isn't the distinction here between Fantasy Sports and FinGen where it was within the control of the customer to activate the code, to get the license. But here, it's not within the control of the customer because that license is not available domestically.
I think that's an excellent point.
That's not what the hotfix did, was to change the customer control?
The hotfix did accomplish that because the customer could not activate that code as infringing by just buying a license. The customer has to be supplied with the hotfix, which itself has code. There's no dispute that that's code, so the code has to be modified. And that, is, as you mentioned, that hotfix, or that patch, I mean, is not available to U.S. customers or even foreign customers that have a box that came from the U.S. It has only been made available to foreign customers who have big IPs that originated in China.
Okay. Let's hear from Mr. Marino, and if you need another moment or so, we'll find some.
Thank you, Mr. Marino. So, the damages issue,
yes.
We asked for a citation to the record for where we disclosed the Malachowski report. So if you look at the appendix at page 55, 59, specifically lines 5 through 8, this is a brief that FI filed in the court saying that in response to document requests, they have served on rather identified the Malachowski report to supplement its damages disclosure. The second point I want to make on damages is, as you heard Mr. Al-Salam refer to the testimony of Mr. Malachowski, our damages expert, he said, Mr. Malachowski confirmed that there was infringement with Professor Rubin, who was our infringement expert. And Professor Rubin told him, the big IP with LTM infringes. She's exactly right. That's undisputed. The big IP with LTM infringes. Professor Rubin never considered or rendered any opinion on the issue of infringement by a single module. That issue was never in this case. The only issue in this case was also always infringement by the big IP with all 14 modules that are under FinGen infringement. That's not in dispute on this appeal. So when Mr. Malachowski pointed in his own testimony, which is the basis of this whole distinction that FI draws, and he said, I confirm with Dr. Professor Rubin,
that LTM infringes, of course, he was talking about the big IP with a single license to LTM. And that product, as we all know, does infringe. And that was the basis, not infringement by LTM by itself, which has never been produced, let alone sold by F5. Now, with respect to the cross-appeal, two issues. Number one, F5 is arguing the wrong standard. The correct standard, the Ninth Circuit law, is no evidence. That's under the EOC case versus GoDaddy. F5, first, there is a confusion here. There's two standards of review that come into play. The trial court reviews for clear evidence. The appellate court reviews the trial court's review of that evidence for abuse of discretion.
Can you just talk about the substance, yes, not the standard review? Why could the jury have found, I gather there are two, there's a Cisco thing and an F5 thing. Why could the jury have reasonably concluded, maybe that's too high a standard, that neither one of them was a single device at earlier than the priority date?
So I'll start with what Jeff White said. Jeff White pointed to the admission on the stand by Mr. Skeen that the F5 products were first combined in 2001. That's in the appendix at page 2353. That's
combined by whom?
The question was, do you know if the 3DNS and BIP were ever combined in a single device? So the question was completely open-ended. And he said, yes. Do you know about when that was? I think it was around the beginning of 2002.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that that question is directed to what we're talking about. We're talking about a theory that before the priority date, that these two things were separate, but that they were used in proximity to one another to accomplish the functionality.
Well,
not
I think
they were combined into a single device.
So this was a cross-examination right after Mr. Skeen had testified on direct about that very issue. So this was, and it was a completely open-ended question that he actually answered with a date that was favorable to Radler.
Was there a claim construction given of this single device?
No, there was not.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess part of it's this, what I kept thinking about is, since the concept of a single device is essentially metaphysically uncertain, the jury could decide anything, whether it's a single device or not.
Potentially, and the jury instruction also said single device. So, but let me give you two other points, because you asked the open-ended question, what evidence could they consider?
What was the jury instruction?
Let me give it to you. Jury instruction. So jury instruction number 10 is in the appendix at 2323. And it says, for the claim to be invalid because it is not new, all the requirements must have existed in a single device that predates. That's a standard jury instruction in the Northern District of California on anticipation, which brings me to my most important point. Anticipation cannot be shown simply by oral testimony under this court's finding precedent. It requires corroboration of documentary evidence. With respect to the Cisco problem, it's admitted in the trial record, was no documentary evidence of the two devices ever being combined. That's what Judge White found in his post-trial order, and they didn't challenge that on appeal. They don't point to any documentary evidence that would supplement the testimonial evidence. And the testimonial evidence, of course, had to be weighed by the jury. The jury didn't have to believe what their witnesses said, who, by the way, at the time, both were F5 employees. So those are, but there's one other very fundamental point, since you asked me what could they have relied on. Judge White didn't address this in his order. But because it's anticipation, the question of what is prior art, is it prior art, and then does the prior art meet all the elements, obviously has to talk about the same thing. And what F5 does in the appeal, it talks about the two devices separately. But the two devices, in order to meet the claim limitations, had to have been combined. How did they combine them? With configuration files. And there was a definition of configuration of configured in the claims. It said it has to be programmed with. So what they did at trial, and we talk about this all over our opposition brief, they brought in a test bed where they sought to combine the two devices. And what did they have to do? They had to configure them or reprogram them with new software to even attempt to meet the claim limitations. And the testimony was unequivocal that those configuration files were created by their expert in 2014. So that element, at the very least, of this combined device, a single device, the configuration file, which is required by the claim, certainly didn't exist until 2014 during the pendency of the case. Jury could have relied on that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Marino. Mr. Al-Salam, you have 2 minutes of rebuttal.
So if I'm limited to the cross-appeal, I'll just...
Just the cross-appeal, please. Okay.
And in the reference to Mr. Skeen's testimony at 1423, the question was, and I'm quoting, do you know if the 3DNS and Big IP were ever combined as a single device? Answer, yes. Do you know about when that was? I think it was around the beginning of 2002. But the next question, what level of difficulty did that involve to put the 3DNS and Big IP into the same device? Answer, it wasn't. It wasn't anything difficult. It was mostly just packaging and putting the bits together so we could deliver one software deliverable to run on one form factor. So when Mr. Skeen was testifying as to one device, he wasn't thinking about the jury instruction or the fact that one device could mean two different modules in the same rack. He took it literally to mean that it was in one package. So that testimony didn't undermine his earlier testimony that they worked together as one device. The test beds that counsel referred to were simply provided to the jury to show that those devices were capable, back in the days of the prior art, of doing link load balancing. They weren't provided as prior art devices themselves. So certainly, we did not have configuration files from 1998 still available in 2013. So they were...
But why is that so certain?
Because those products were old and outdated long, long ago. So this is 13 years later or more than that, with the time of trial. So we didn't use the same software anymore. That no longer existed. So the expert created configuration files simply to show how they could have worked back in that time period. In terms of the cross appeal, that's all I have.
Okay. Any more questions? Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
both.
You.
The case is taken under submission. That concludes the arguments.